Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We all know how we're supposed to eat, right? Plenty of fruits and vegetables, rounded out with whole grains, legumes, nuts, and lean meats. Not too much saturated fat, very little sugar or salt, and as little commercially processed food as possible. If we're being honest, though, a lot of us would have to admit we could do better. So at any pharmacy or food store, we can find a dizzying array of little bottles that promise to deliver all the vitamins we miss out on when we pick the fries over the fruit cup, all in an easy-to-swallow pill form. Perhaps not surprisingly, as my guest is here to tell us, reality is a bit more complicated. The new book by journalist Catherine Price is called Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection. Catherine, welcome to Think. Hi, Catherine. Welcome to Think.
Hi. It's great to be with you.
What is a vitamin exactly?
Well, that is a great place to start because I think we often confuse the definition of that term when we talk about vitamins in general. So there are actually only 13 human vitamins, and those are the letters that you probably are familiar with from childhood or from the Flintstones, which is A, D, E, K, C, and then the 8 B vitamins that have other names like riboflavin and niacin. So that's very different from the much larger category of dietary supplements that, as you mentioned, you know, line the drugstore or supermarket shelves. And the important thing to keep in mind with the vitamins themselves is that they are definitely essential for our health. If you don't have vitamins, then you will get a deficiency disease and oftentimes die. So, you know, roughly speaking, the definition of a vitamin could be said to be a specific chemical that we need in very small amounts to avoid a deficiency that we usually get from food.
So vitamins are about regulating the chemical processes that take place in our bodies?
Yeah, well, I mean, what's interesting about them is that they do different things. If you get to the chemical level, there's actually no technical definition of a vitamin. But roughly speaking, yeah, they're necessary for reactions that help our bodies to run. And without those chemicals, the reactions can't take place and bad things happen.
How far out of whack do things have to get before we start to feel the effects physically?
I mean, they have to get pretty far out of effect, you know, out of whack. If you don't have enough of a vitamin for a couple days or weeks, it probably won't do very much. But, you know, our bodies store different amounts of each vitamin in our tissues, so it kind of is a case-by-case basis again.
We all learned in, like, second grade about sailors and explorers getting scurvy way back when. This book, though, I think is a fascinating reminder of how common dietary deficiencies once were throughout the world and still are today in places where severe poverty is endemic.
Yeah, that was very interesting to me as well. I mean, I actually learned about scurvy in third grade, so you were ahead of me on that one. But, yeah, you know, we all know these stories of these poor sailors with their teeth falling out and these loose gums and stuff. I think what we don't realize even from those stories is how horrible scurvy is, and it's a good example of how dramatic a deficiency can be. So, you know, back in the age of exploration, ship captains and governments would actually count on losing 50% of their men to scurvy on any major voyage. Huge deal and a very gruesome way to die. And you also bring up a very good point, though, that today these deficiency diseases do still exist, and you'll never be able to get rid of them totally because the only prevention is good nutrition. And there's a lot of places in the world where people don't have adequate access to vitamins, whether it's through their food or through supplements. And for example, vitamin A deficiency is an enormous problem worldwide right now, leading to hundreds of thousands of cases of blindness and also death, particularly with children.
And this is one thing that fascinatingly has been addressed through the invention of a kind of rice that sort of grows and produces more vitamin A than it would naturally have.
Yes. So you're referring to golden rice, which is a genetically modified type of rice that has been made to create beta-carotene, which is a precursor to vitamin A in its endosperm. And the endosperm is a part of the rice that we eat. It's one of many potential ways to get vitamin A to people who need it. So it's kind of an interesting example. It tends to get lumped in with the larger debate on GMOs, and one of the points I made in my book is I think it's a good example of how we should bring more nuance to the subject of GMOs and how to solve these problems. But there are other ways to try to get more beta-carotene to people who need it. You know, one way is actually to just get vitamin A supplements. If you have a supplement and you can give a kid a twice yearly dose just by putting it in their mouth, that will prevent vitamin A deficiency, but it's very difficult, if not impossible, to get vitamin A supplements to all the kids who need them. And another way is just developing crops that naturally produce more beta-carotene. But it's such an enormous problem. There's no one easy solution to this issue.
How did scientists begin to understand, first of all, that the food we ate and, you know, the variety of food we ate might have something to do with our overall health? Because I guess for a long time, people just figured if you had enough to fill your belly, you might be okay.
Yeah, and nutrition is a really interesting subject to trace because throughout its history, we seem to always think we have everything figured out, including today. So, yes, in the late 1800s, there was a lot of work being done with measuring the calories in food and the protein, fat, and carbohydrate. People thought that was everything you needed to have in food. It was energy. You know, food was just kind of a lump of coal. That itself was a really big realization that we really do burn food in our bodies like a slow-burning fire. But then the way that we really started to figure out the issue of the vitamins was not by starting with the idea of vitamins at all. It was recognizing these strange diseases that no one could explain, including scurvy, which we now know as vitamin C, or beriberi, which hardly any of us know about today, but it's a thiamine deficiency. And basically, it was the process of trying to figure out these very strange diseases and then eventually connecting them with diet. You know, people recognized that there was a connection between citrus fruit and scurvy, but they didn't know that that was because there was a specific substance in the oranges that was preventing scurvy. So it was a very long process that it took a very long time to actually figure out. And the word vitamin was actually only coined in 1911, and the concept of vitamins was only introduced, you know, basically around that time, a little bit before, and the first vitamin was chemically isolated in 1926. So it's surprisingly recent.
The scurvy story is very interesting because there was experimentation going on. People recognized this was a really serious problem. And there were some sort of false starts in getting a solution because, for one thing, like for a while, people said, great, we'll make sailors have this lime drink and we'll cook it first, which took, I guess, a lot of the vitamin C out of it.
Yeah, you know, there's many reasons that it was difficult to figure out the vitamins. And the one that you're talking about is, even when people kind of realized there was a connection between citrus and scurvy, they would do things, as you're saying, like boil down citrus juice to give to the sailors. But unfortunately, heat destroys vitamin C, so even though that's the right idea, it didn't actually work. Another example would be that Britain, once they realized and really did acknowledge this connection between citrus fruit and scurvy, gave the sailors limes instead of lemons. That's where we get limey from for mm-hmm. a British person. And that was because they controlled a lot of colonies that grew limes. But what they didn't realize is limes have less vitamin C than oranges. So, you know, that will work, but it's not as effective.
Do vitamins affect the flavor of food?
These days, not really, because there's very sophisticated ways to create flavors in food that offset potential bad flavors. But in my research, I was just curious about tasting them in their raw form because I just couldn't wrap my mind around these, like, tiny invisible substances that we needed to stay alive. And so I made people show me, you know, little bottles of isolated vitamins and that I asked if it was okay if I tried them. And I can tell you, like, vitamin B1, for example, thiamine, is really bitter. So if you put that into a food, you're going to have to do something to offset the taste.
So let's talk about this. I have a sister who eats very well today. You know, she's an adult woman with a job and a mortgage and all that. But for a while in college, basically, her diet was like whatever she could buy at the Texaco station with her credit card, right? So a lot of Twix and cereal and SpaghettiOs, processed food. Why did she not get scurvy or beriberi or night blindness or something equally awful?
Well, I mean, probably because she was eating enough foods that had been fortified with synthetic vitamins that she was not suffering from an overt deficiency. And, you know, as we were talking about before, it's you kind of have to work at it to give yourself scurvy these days. You could, but I don't really recommend it. So I would say that it's an interesting example because she probably was suffering from deficiencies in some vitamins if she was eating foods that were so poor they didn't actually even have man-made vitamins in them. On the flip side, in the United States, we are fortunate enough to have basically a lot of synthetic vitamins that are added to the food supply by the companies making the foods. It's not mandated by government, but you know, most flour used to make Twinkies or whatever is going to have been enriched with thiamine and a bunch of B vitamins. So basically, I think that she actually has a history to thank in a way, and the fact that food manufacturers have put synthetic vitamins in our foods for a long time, and that actually really does protect a lot of us.
It also allows us to not really realize if we're eating a lot of junk food.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if there weren't that fortification and she was existing on Twix and SpaghettiOs, then she probably would have had to do something about her diet.
She has. I just want to be clear about that.
She's going to be like, you were saying bad things about me on the radio.
She takes very good care of her health now. But there is this idea that we've become almost dependent on processed foods, which are, you know, processed so much that the vitamins go away. We're dependent on somebody coming back in and pumping them back in artificially.
I mean, yeah, that was a realization to me as I was writing the book. You know, because you kind of tend to break categories down in your mind of either people who are just eating kale and spinach and stuff, and then people who are eating just totally horrible diets that don't have any vitamins at all. And in reality, that ignores the enormous middle ground of most of us, which are people who do eat a fair amount of processed or packaged foods, and we're actually getting a surprising percentage of our vitamins and other and minerals, actually, from those processed foods because they've had those things added back. So I wouldn't say we're dependent on processed foods. I would say that we have an addiction to that, and the vitamins in them are keeping us healthy.
My guest is journalist Catherine Price. Her new book is called Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. SMU Summer Youth has hands-on workshops in robotics, Minecraft, game design, and visual arts for students entering K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration opens March 3rd at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Catherine Price. Her new book is called Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. All right, Catherine, when we cook food or when we just have it around, like let's just take the people who eat nothing but kale, right? That kale is going to be better for them 2 days after it's picked than it will a week and a half later.
I guess probably, but I think the percentage of Americans who are existing primarily on kale you know, they're probably fine anyway. And I would say for the rest of us, if we eat that kale 2 days after it's picked or a week after it's picked, it's still good for us to eat the kale. But, you know, it is an interesting point. People do get wrapped up in the question of, for example, raw versus cooked, whether or not we should get our food above a certain temperature, things like that. And what I found in my own research is that in terms of vitamins, it really depends on the vitamin. So, for example, a fat-soluble vitamin, like beta-carotene, the precursor to vitamin A, you'll actually absorb more of that if you cook it in fat. So that will go against the whole raw food idea, whereas other ones you'll absorb better when they're raw. But I don't think it's really something we need to get too worked up about because so few of us are eating that way anyway. Then I say the further you can get in that direction, the better. And if you like your vegetables cooked, maybe don't cook them to the point of making them into a mush. But if you don't do that, you still should be getting benefits.
Let's talk about how much we're supposed to have. I like the idea of something so official sounding as the USRDA, the Recommended Daily Allowance. How did those numbers get set, and do they actually reflect what we ought to be consuming on a pretty regular basis?
So this might be a little disturbing to people, but the recommended dietary allowances are very much works in progress and not meant to be taken personally. And so it's not good to fixate on them too much when you're deciding what to eat. But the story of their creation is that in the 40s, during World War II, there was concern about whether or not the nation was going to be well-nourished enough for war. And in World War I, the concern had been calories, whether Americans would have enough energy. In World War II, this focus shifted to vitamins. And one of the things that happened as a result was that this board called the Food and Nutrition Board was created at the Institute of Medicine, which is a non-governmental body. and they were commissioned by Congress to come up with an estimate for how much of the vitamins and minerals Americans needed to get. So if you look at the history of that, it's very interesting to see what the committee itself had to say about the process, because they didn't have many good studies. It was difficult, if not impossible, to actually measure most of the vitamins at that point. And they basically had to just make, you know, their best guess about what we needed. They also needed to set their estimates and their recommendations very high, because they were making population-wide recommendations. The same thing is true today. So the actual definition of a recommended dietary allowance is the amount of a nutrient thought to meet the needs of 97 to 98% of the people in a particular group, say men, you know, 17 to 50 or whatever. And the analogy I like to make there is that means that, you know, 97 of us could get by perfectly fine on less. And the analogy I make is it's kind of like the government has to come up, you know, make a sweater that's going to fit 97 to 98% of the American population. That's going to be a big sweater because it has to fit everybody. But so if you're like 90 pounds, you'll fit in the sweater, but you don't need that sweater to be that big. But they need to make it that forgiving just to make sure everyone's needs are going to be covered. So I would say to keep that in mind when you look at the RDAs. And the other thing I'd like to point out to people that I certainly didn't know when I was starting my research process was that when you look at the back of your food or your supplement, and you see this nutrition facts or supplement facts panel back there, and they have a percent DV that tells you presumably what percent of a particular vitamin or mineral a serving of that food gives you, those recommendations are actually based on the version of the RDAs that came out in 1968.
Wow.
Not the most recent ones. So that's something to keep in mind. So if you think your breakfast cereal is giving you 100% of everything you need, first of all, it's not meant to be taken personally, and second, it's based on outdated recommendations. And then the third thing I would say is that it's supposed to be over time, so you don't need to meet these targets every single day. It's your average over time.
Well, a lot of people who are trying to do the right thing, right, they look at those nutrition facts panels and they think, I'm probably not getting enough, you know, thiamine or niacin or whatever. And so they walk into a drugstore or a GNC and they decide to buy some vitamins.
Yeah, I would say anyone who asks that question or thinks that to themselves probably is getting enough thiamine and niacin and everything. It's kind of an easy way to tell. If you think to ask the question, you're probably fine. It's the people who aren't asking the question that are of more concern.
So what's in those vitamins that we can buy? Some of them say right on the package that they have, you know, whatever, 10,000% of the U.S. RDA.
What is in them in terms of...
They're the amount that they can have in them is not necessarily, you know, that packaged vitamins. They don't necessarily simply reflect what you're thought to need on a pretty consistent basis. Some people really think it might be a great idea to, you know, triple up on the dose of whatever you're supposed to have.
Yeah, if you go into a drugstore or a grocery store, like you're saying, and you want to buy a vitamin supplement, again, I'm talking right now about just vitamins, not the larger category of dietary supplements, but there's a wide range of the dose that you could get in particular vitamins. Even within multivitamins, you know, one brand can differ from one to the other in terms of the percentage of the RDA that it claims to give you. So that actually is a result of a 1976 amendment that basically forbade the FDA from ever setting limits on how much of a particular vitamin or mineral a particular product could contain, and also forbade them from establishing definitions for what terms meant. So say a multivitamin, I mean, you can have a multivitamin like one of the gummies that I know many adults actually love just as much, if not more, than children. And the gummy vitamin will not actually have the same vitamins in it as a standard vitamin or a Flintstones vitamin. So it can be tricky. You really need to do your homework.
Can we be confident that they actually contain vitamins? We've heard so much lately about, you know, herbal supplements sometimes containing like grass clippings and who knows what else.
Yeah, the question of trust with dietary supplements in general is a difficult one to answer, because there are a lot of problems with America's dietary supplement market when it comes to whether the products actually have what they claim to. I can talk more about that if you want, but I would say in terms of vitamins, thankfully they're kind of on the end where there are fewer problems, but that's not to say that there aren't problems with them. The most common problems I've read about with vitamins are cases where a vitamin product will have far more or far less of a particular vitamin than the label claims. Some of that is simply because, as you mentioned before, certain vitamins disintegrate over time. And so if you want to have a vitamin supplement that has the right amount, when the consumer actually takes it, you might need to put in what's called an overage to, you know, under the assumption that some of it is going to degrade. But basically, yeah, I mean, there are definitely concerns. For vitamins, I would say try to go with as big a brand as possible, but also you can't always trust the label. It's a difficult question to answer.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Rita in Grand Saline. Hi, Rita.
Hi. Fascinating subject. As a healthcare professional, who also uses quite a bit of supplements and homeopathy, I'm curious to know, in our society now that focuses on organic and non-processed foods, how much, if you're truly eating organic, how many oranges a week would you have to eat to get enough vitamin C to where it's not problematic? And the second part of that question is, I know there are things, behaviors and whatnot in the environment that deplete vitamins, such as smoking depletes vitamin C in the body, and how much would you have to take maybe or to compensate that for that? And also, last but not least, I was curious to know if the book addresses the issue of overdosing on vitamins that are fat-soluble versus vitamin-soluble.
Lots in that question, Rita.
Fat-soluble versus water-soluble. Excuse me.
Thanks so much
for
your call.
Let's see if we can answer all three of those. I would say, okay, first, how many oranges would you have to eat? Off the top of my head, I can't tell you, partially because oranges will vary in their vitamin C content between breeds and also how they were grown and picked, et cetera. But it won't take that many. The RDA for vitamin C for most adults is 90 milligrams a day, and it really doesn't take that much, especially because vitamin C is in a bunch of other things. Your second question about having negative environmental influences that can harm the amount of vitamins in your body, it's an interesting point to bring up because it is true that if you smoke a cigarette, things like your vitamin C and your folate levels will actually decline pretty quickly. So the question of how much you need to take to make up for that or how much you need to eat, I mean, I can't say because that would be an individual basis. Again, it's not going to give you scurvy or a folate deficiency immediately. But I think it's important for people to recognize because it is a pretty concrete example of how something like smoking has an immediate deleterious effect on your body. And then lastly, yes, the book does get into the question of what would happen if you took way too much of fat-soluble vitamins, which is A, D, E, and K. A is the one to be most concerned about because it can be toxic to your liver more quickly than the other ones. So you definitely don't want to go popping a handful of vitamin A tablets. And the other example I like to bring up there is D, which you're not going to have an immediate D overdose, but it's an example of a vitamin that regulates something else in our bodies, in this case calcium absorption. So a high level of vitamin D over time might interfere with your calcium absorption and make you pull too much calcium out of food. And whereas calcium is obviously good for your bones, you don't want to have calcium deposits in soft tissues in your body, like your kidney or your arteries. So, you have to think of the broader picture when you talk about vitamins. What else are they doing and what else could they have effects on?
So it's so American of us, right, to think that if the right amount is good, then 50 times the right amount has got to be better. But we ought to proceed with caution if we're supplementing.
Yes, yes. And I think that vitamins are an interesting example of that because with the water-soluble ones, the other ones besides the ones I just mentioned, for the most part, you're not going to see an immediate really bad effect from taking a lot of them. People like to joke that Americans have the most expensive urine in the world because we take all these multivitamins and supplements and then we just pee them out. But I think what's important for us to keep in mind is that you have to saturate your body with vitamins before you're going to start peeing them out. And there's a difference between the amount of a vitamin you need and total saturation point. And we don't actually know what the long-term effects of constantly being saturated might be. So you might feel fine and not see anything in the short term, but who knows over time what constantly doing that to your body will do. And one example of that is the question of antioxidants. C is an antioxidant. A lot of people take a lot of C because of that. But there's been recent research suggesting that you could have too many antioxidants. There does seem to be a purpose for free radicals in the body, which is the compound type of compound that antioxidants counterbalance. So, I just think we need to take a step back and recognize all that we still don't know about the long-term effects of these things.
Another thing we don't entirely know is about how vitamins that occur naturally within foods might be interacting with other kinds of micronutrients that aren't necessarily classified as vitamins, but might have some effect on how these things act in our bodies.
Right. So it's a question of synergy, and it's an important point to bring up because people often ask, you know, are vitamins better in food or in supplements? And part of the reason that so many nutritionists, or the main reason, one of the main reasons nutritionists say you should get them from food doesn't have so much to do with the vitamins themselves, which are mostly the same, man-made or in natural form. It has to do a lot with what else is in those foods that naturally contain vitamins. And you know, one example, well, let me step back for a second. I should say what you're getting at is the question of synergy, which is how these things work together differently from how they work on their own. And the analogy I like to think of there is how each of us acts very differently, I would imagine, in the privacy of our own home than we do in a group at work or at a party. And it's kind of hard to predict. So if you take any of these substances out of their context, you can't have any assurance that they're acting the same way they would in their original form. And that's why I don't really like the idea of this isolation of specific nutrients, whether they're vitamins or anything else, and just taking them out of their context. And also in levels that don't really match up to what they would normally be.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Jared on the line in Dallas. Hello, Jared.
Hi. I'm backtracking just a little bit. Could the speaker comment on the difference between the quality controls in place for prescription drugs versus multivitamins over the counter? Because I don't want people to get confused because the FDA actually does monitor and require stringent tests performed on prescription drugs. Could you talk a little bit about that?
I could talk a lot about that, but I will limit myself to say that it's a very important distinction to be made between the regulation of America's supplements, by which I mean vitamins and just the larger category of dietary supplements, and the way that we regulate drugs, whether they be over-the-counter or a prescription. And the most important distinction to keep in mind is that there are very, very strict regulations in place for pharmaceutical drugs and prescription drugs to make sure that they are both safe and effective before they're sold. And that's why it can take so long for drugs to be approved. It's an average of about 12 years, and it costs billions with a B of dollars, which can be very frustrating to people waiting for a cure for or some kind of treatment for a disease. But on the flip side, it does ensure that you can trust that what you're taking is what it says on the label and that this product is going to do what it says and hopefully not hurt you at the same time. Obviously, it may have side effects because drugs have side effects, but at least there'll be known side effects for the most part.
Going back to... Go ahead, please.
I was just going to answer. Yeah, the other side of his question, though, is that dietary supplements, on the other hand, because of a law passed in 1994 that was heavily influenced by the supplement industry, they don't have to be tested for safety or for efficacy before they're sold. And I think that's something a lot of people don't fully realize because they're sold in drugstores next to the Tylenol or next to the Advil, and you kind of assume that they've gone through the same process as either a prescription or over-the-counter drug, and they have not.
Going back to something that our caller Rita mentioned, you know, she said something about, you know, people are trying to eat organic. To be clear, I have nothing against organic foods, but they don't typically contain more or less vitamins than conventionally grown produce. Is that correct?
That was a question I wanted to find out the answer to also, and it didn't get into the book, but I had several really interesting conversations with some plant physiologists at USDA, an underappreciated group of people because they're very interesting. And I remember one of them talking about how, like all of these questions, it's more nuanced than you'd think because there can be differences between organic and non-organic produce, but it's not necessarily in one direction or the other. Part of it has to do with the conditions under which they're grown. So if you have an organic food or fruit, say, and you're not using pesticides, it's going to have to produce a lot more chemicals on its own than it would if you actually were using pesticides. So if those are the chemicals you want, then it's a good choice.
My guest is journalist Catherine Price. Her new book is called Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by sending email to think@kera.org, by tweeting me at Chris Boyd Think, or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. SMU Summer Youth has hands-on workshops in robotics, Minecraft, game design, and visual arts for students entering K-12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration opens March 3rd at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Catherine Price. Her new book is called Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Catherine, this is a serious work of journalism, but I have to say I sort of laughed at the chapter in which you describe walking into, I don't know if it was a vitamin shop or a GNC, but you had some skin issues. And you thought you would ask for a recommendation. Can you tell us about your experience there?
Sure, and I'm glad you laughed because, you know, I like writing things that I think are funny and it's, try to get that into the vitamins as much as possible. But yes, so that story is that I was interested in the subject that a previous caller brought up, which was dietary supplements. And so I went into a GNC, and I started asking the clerk about whether or not she could help me with the fact that I'd gotten these like weird dry rashes on my body, and I wanted to see if perhaps there was some kind of supplement that could help me because I'd tried all sorts of doctor's appointments and Aveeno concoctions, and nothing seemed to be helping. And so she recommended a particular product to me, and I used that as an entry point to explore the broader question of how you can tell what a supplement does and how we got to the point that they're regulated in the way that I was describing in response to Jared's question.
And there's also the question of the placebo effect, because some of these are probably really well tested and some of them not so much.
Well, yeah, I think the placebo effect is a wonderful thing. I mean, if you have something that is truly harmless and you believe that it's doing something good for you and then it does something good for you, that's great. It's
right.
Not going to have any side effects because it's not actually, there's nothing in it. So there's certainly, I think, supplements that play that role. My concern, though, is that there's also a lot of supplements out there that contain things that could be bad for you and could have side effects and that we don't really know about when we start just taking them.
We have an interesting email here from Michael, who asks, is there a risk today with not getting enough iodine? Iodized salt still exists, but gourmet and sea salts are not fortified, nor are packaged foods with sodium.
So that is a mineral. So I'm going to say first off that I wrote about vitamins, so whatever anyone asks me about minerals, I have to put a huge caveat about that. But I will say that, iodine, it's an interesting one because without iodine, you'll develop a goiter, and it's actually a leading cause of mental retardation and a huge problem in the developing world. So it's a serious issue. And America's salt supply has been iodized for the most part. I think it's since 1923. And that is why we don't have much of those two problems of, or basically the problem of iodine deficiency here. But I have read some things recently about the potential issue, like your emailer is saying, about the fact that there are more foods now that are not actually being fortified with iodine, but I don't know enough about it to really be able to comment in much detail.
Just generally speaking, what's the difference between a vitamin, those 13 that you identified, and a mineral?
Well, vitamins are made by living things, and they contain carbon. They're organic, and the minerals are actually elements. So they're made of just one thing, and they don't contain carbon. So that's things like calcium, iron, iodine.
So they may have similar effects within the body, but they're just created in a different way.
Well, they're both essential. So they're both things that we need in order to stay alive, but they're doing different things in the body.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Darren on the line in Plano. Hey, Darren.
Hey, this is a wonderful topic. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I was wondering, there's been a lot of articles recently about how effective these multivitamins are and whether our bodies absorb them. I wonder if your guest could talk about what the current research is and how effective they are.
Multivitamins in particular?
Yes.
So multivitamins, I mean, they are effective if you have an actual vitamin deficiency. And, I mean, I like to be sure to make this point when that subject comes up because in the case of an actual deficiency, we really do need vitamins. So there's cases when multivitamins really make a difference. So I guess the question is what we mean by effective. If you mean effective against other stuff, like is it going to protect you from some sort of other condition, then no, I don't think the evidence is there to support that. There's no major health organization in the U.S. that recommends the routine use of multivitamins for otherwise healthy people because that hasn't been proven. So, yeah. But if you were to actually, as the poor sister who got picked on earlier in the show, in the case of the Twinkie or the Twix diet, the multivitamin would both be a good idea and likely be effective in terms of, I mean, there's not big problems with most of them being absorbed.
What about people who worry that their children, you know, you always know that one person whose kids will only eat chicken fingers and white bread, and they think, okay, I'm gonna make sure that there's a Flintstones vitamin or some gummy vitamins just to kind of act as an insurance policy in case this child is not ingesting the foods that he or she really ought to be.
Well, yeah, the situation with kids is similar to adults, except that someone has to be in control of the kid's diet, and so someone external is getting really worried about it, I guess. I mean, we should be worried about, for our kids, similar things for ourselves. And there definitely are many cases where kids and adolescents in particular are actually not getting enough vitamins. So I'd say the ideal solution, of course, would be to somehow sneak broccoli into that buttered pasta, but that is obviously not feasible a lot of the time. So while you're working on your child's palate, I don't think there's any harm in giving them a multivitamin. I think what you do need to watch out for, though, is that now there's an increasing number of other foods that have been fortified with synthetic vitamins that, if you put them all together, can get pretty high. So you don't want to be aiming to, or it's better not to get into a situation where you're consuming multiples of your RDA of vitamin or that your child is. So one way or the other, I mean, keep an eye on whether or not they're getting close to the RDA, keeping in mind what I said before about the imprecision of the RDAs. So it's kind of a rambling answer. Fine if you could give your kid a multivitamin. There are kids who could benefit from it. But again, if you're a parent who's really worried about that, chances are your kid is pretty well off.
You know what the internet loves, Catherine? Superfoods. You know, if you believe what you see in social media, like eating blueberries and pomegranate seeds will basically keep you alive till you're 149. What did you learn about superfoods and what they might or might not have going for them besides simply their vitamin and mineral content?
Well, I hate to say it, but there's no such thing as a superfood. There's foods that are definitely better for us than others. I mean, I personally, I'm a big fan of blueberries. It's like my favorite food ever, actually, which makes me sound really, I don't know, nutritionally dorky or something. But I think that has a lot to do with the way that food is covered in the media. And I myself am a member of the media, so I speak from experience here. But first of all, things like blueberries and walnuts and kale and things make very pretty pictures, and so there's a tendency to want to feature them and pull them out. And the second, you can always find a study where someone is looking at lycopene in tomatoes or like resveratrol in red wine or something that you can pull out and make into a little headline. And I think that tendency combined with our human desire to have an easy answer for things makes us gravitate towards the idea of superfoods. In reality, the foods that are being touted as superfoods are good for us, but they're not the one answer. So try to eat a balance that does contain a lot of them, but don't think that that those flax seeds are going to protect you and keep you alive till you're 150.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Paul in Dallas. Hey, Paul.
Yes. My question is, your guest talks a lot about your own individual situation when she talks about, you know, the consumption of these vitamins. I'm wondering, is there a source, is there a place, is there like a specialist that I can visit that will tell me what I need for my own body?
Oh, Paul, that's a great question that Catherine is like supremely ready to answer.
Well, yeah, it is a great question. I would say, first off, there's a lot of tests being marketed right now to measure your vitamin and nutrient levels and various things, and those are not substantiated, so I would suggest not wasting your money on that. I would say the first question for yourself to be asking is just what you're eating, and like we were talking about earlier, which of those three categories you fall into. Are you eating the way that all of us know we're supposed to be eating, with the fruits and the vegetables and the fatty fish and things like that? If you are, then you're probably just fine, with a couple of potential exceptions I'll get to in a second. Are you part of that larger middle category who's eating a lot of processed foods that have added vitamins, like breakfast cereal, sports bars, things like that. In that case, your bases are probably covered on vitamins, but you might want to consider going to some of those other foods to get the other potential nutrients that we don't really understand that don't exist in the processed foods. And then if you are existing on Twix bars, then I would suggest first reevaluating your diet before turning to a multivitamin, but you probably will have some problems. And then I'd also just point out there are specific instances where your supplementation can be very important, and it's important to talk to your doctor about these. For example, if you were to be a vegan and not eat any animal products, you might be deficient in vitamin B12, which is made by bacteria in animals' guts, and so you can't really get enough of it if you're just eating non-animal foods. If you're over 50 or 60 or so, you also might want to check about B12 because it becomes more difficult to absorb as we age. If you were to be, you just really don't sound like you're a woman of childbearing age, but if you were to be, then you do want to pay attention to folic acid because it's very important in the prevention of a potentially devastating type of birth defect called neural tube defects. So there are and if you have a digestive disease like Crohn's or irritable bowel syndrome where you have trouble with digestion in general, that can cause problems with micronutrient deficiencies. So what I would say to you is to evaluate your diet yourself, first of all, and then second, touch base with your doctor to see if you have any of these specific conditions or lifestyle choices that might mean that you should look into a supplement in a particular micronutrient.
What's on the horizon with regard to something like genetic testing to find out what specifically we might need?
Well, there are also companies trying to do that, although a lot of them got shut down after the 23andMe was the biggest one, and then that got, I don't think that one in particular exists. I actually did one of those. Right now, I mean, it's interesting because we are beginning to be able to find variations in people's genetic codes that might have some association with specific diseases or that might demonstrate that they will react differently to certain things in the diet than others. For example, one of my hypotheses is the reason that you see so many studies that say that for some people that coffee is going to, like, make you live forever, and then the next study says it's going to kill you. Probably there are people who react differently to things like caffeine and have a genetic predisposition. We just don't really understand them yet. It's very unwise for us to try to assume that the whole population will react the same way to anything when it comes to nutrition. With that said, the genetic tests now are not precise enough to really give you much useful information. The one I took was basically like, you should eat fruits and vegetables. Like, I know I should. That's why I took the test. You're supposed to tell me something else.
Right.
So I don't recommend spending your money on them at this point in time.
It seems like everybody who has been to the doctor in the last 5 years has been told they have a vitamin D deficiency.
Vitamin D. It's an intriguing vitamin, and I think all the vitamins are intriguing. So vitamin D in particular interests me. Let me start off with the bad news, which is that there's so much that we don't know about vitamin D. No, I'll start with the good news. That's better. Here's what we know about vitamin D. It's essential for calcium absorption and regulation, as I was talking about before. So it plays a crucial role in bone health. I will also say vitamin D exists naturally in very few foods. Basically, fatty fish and their livers are the best sources. So if you really love cod liver oil, more power to you, you're probably fine. But I believe that evolutionarily we probably were meant to get it from the sun because vitamin D is a really weird vitamin. We make it in response to sunlight in our skin. But these days, I mean, you guys are in Texas, but I'm in Philadelphia, so it's winter here. I do not have much skin showing, and when I do, it's covered in suntan lotion or sunblock, which prevents that conversion from happening. So that's what we do know. I listened to a two-day webinar at NIH about vitamin D, and I was just amazed by how little else is known. And when I say that, I mean experts don't know the other things vitamin D does in our bodies. So while there is a lot of interesting and suggestive research that all of your listeners and everyone has probably seen in the news about other things D might do, that's not really conclusive yet. But we also don't know how much of D we need. We also don't know when you take those tests if they're actually accurate because you have a problem where the results from one lab for the same blood sample can be different from another. And there's also no consensus on what the definition of deficiency is. So when your doctor says you're deficient, that's kind of an arbitrary line that's being drawn that the experts don't agree on. So it's a really tricky one. And I would say that for me, I think I don't get enough D, and with the acknowledgement that I don't know what enough is, but I just know that I'm not getting very much. And so for me, I might consider a supplement, but it varies by person. And I think that it's really important for us to recognize that if you do decide to take a supplement in D, you're basing that on not on firm science that's been established. You're kind of hedging your bets.
The new book by journalist Catherine Price is called Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection. Catherine, thanks so much for joining us, and you feel free to come down to Texas and get some vitamin D sometime.
Thank you so much for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered today by Alan Roberts. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. And if you'd like to email the show, you can send it to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.